Thank you for the invitation to give a seminar. And first of all, I'm very happy to be here and to see the sun finally after several months of rain. And okay, and I arrived yesterday, so I'm a bit jet lag, and I hope that it will be fine for the talk, but let's see. The main focus of the talk will be this paper we did in collaboration with Gianfranco and a PhD student in Amsterdam, Hamish, which wants to describe the complementarity between dye detection searches and neutrino signal for the reconstruction of WIMP parameters. So. Since you are an expert of dark matter, I don't want to go to do any kind of introduction, but as I said, the main focus will be to consider the dark matter as a piling to be a WIMP, a weak interactive massive particle. And as you know, you can search for heat in several ways, like with the dye detection, the recall of the WIMP of a nucleus scattering in underground detectors. So, it will scatter off a quark of the standard model. And then we can search for it through indirect detection with the signal in the halo or coming from the sun, which will the second focus on talk. And then it can be produced at LHC. So, but first, I will mainly consider this dye detection part. And so this is the dye detection map of all dye detection going on, experiment running right now or planned that should be constructed. So there is a huge effort in this in this sense, and there are almost like 20 experiments that are going on, which have different properties, different nuclei, more light, so sensitive to light dark matter, or heavier, like xenon, 1 ton, and they use all different detection techniques. And but maybe you have heard even more than me in the conference last week, but just to resume the status of the dye detection status right now, it's a bit puzzling because we have 4 experiments that has a claim of detection. So the first one is a CREST, Cogent, which has some excess in the total rate and also claims to have a modulated signal. This is the those are the old data of 2 years ago, and these excess point to a light WIMP of the order of 10 GV and high spin independent cross section. Then we have CREST, which also has only an excess in the total rate, and this is the spectrum, which is the sum of all the moduli and all the detector in CREST, and so one can see the excess in the signal times the even the energy. And we have like 77 events, which are analyzed from the collaboration. They give the 4 sigma detection. Then there is the old known Dama Libra signal, which is around for 13 years now, which has a 8-10 sigma detection of Fahanwall modulation. And there is the newly claim of detection of from CDMS silicium. So those are the 3 events. This is the recall energy of the detector. Here there are the 2 events close to the threshold. And this is what the collaboration, the plot from the collaboration. So the mass of the WIMP versus the spin independent cross section. And this blue region is the one preferred by CMS, silicium, which points to a 8 GV or so dark matter mass, of which a cross section slightly more than 10 minus 41 centimeter cube. Square, And then this is the overlaps with cogent. This is the crest excess, this is gamma, and then all these excess are in conflict with the upper bound. The most constraining one is probably xenon 100, and then there are some other low threshold experiment like xenon 10 that have moved from the paper of Sarkar. So this this puzzling situation with the addition of CDMS silicium has been discussed recently in this work here, for example. So I'm not going to really focus on that. This was just to set the current status of the dark matter. And but what I wanted to say is that, for example, it's puzzling this situation because we have both experimental and theoretical issues for the dark detection. So the experimental issues are, for example, that a very small event rate is predicted. This is the recoil energy versus the rate for example, xenon, germanium, or argon, the detector. For example, if we take the xenon and have a threshold of 15 GeV, only 8 events per 100 kilo per year are predicted. So this is kind of challenging to construct this detector. They should be huge, they should run for a long time, and they should push the threshold the lowest possible in order to increase the rate and also to be sensitive to this to the WIMP recoil of the nucleus, because the typical energy of recoil for a WIMP is of the order of the KV. So the lower the threshold, the better. But this condition, the small event rate and the lowest threshold, can also be a source of systematics, including also the background discrimination, because the lower the threshold, the more background the experiment we have, and they also have to understand the behavior of the detector at low threshold. So, for example, they can be measured in identify electrons or neutrons that mimic WIMP. So this is the experimental part, which is a kind of a challenge. And the systematics from the experiment should be taken into account. An example is, for example, for in the xenon 100 detector, they have this conversion between recoil energy and what they see, which are photoelectron volt, which is very not very known close to the threshold. They can move the bound at low WIMP. This is, for example, one of the problem of one systematic that the experiment can have. And on the other hand, we have theoretical issues. First of all, the dark matter and the cross section of the mass of the dark matter and the cross section are unknown and can span several orders of magnitude. And the second part is the astrophysics that describes the dark matter. So, for example, the velocity distribution. Here we have an embodied simulation of a Milky Way-like galaxy, and this is exactly the from 7 to 9 kiloparsec, mimicking the position of the sun. And on top of that, there are several parameterization of the velocity distribution, while this red magenta one is the Maxwell-Boltzmann. And as you can see, for example, this Maxwell-Boltzmann does not really reproduce the n-body simulation in this high tail part, which is the most important for the direct detection, because only WIMP that have enough velocity can scatter and produce a recoil which can be seen in the detector, and those WIMP comes of course from this tail, this high tail velocity. So This is one of the main issues to correctly parameterize, and going beyond the Maxwellian Hegel can be important. And another issue, it's also the astrophysics in general of the dark matter at the sun position. For example, its local velocity, the escape velocity from the Hegel, or the local dark matter density, because all those quantities are uncertain by a factor of 10%, 20%, or even a factor of 2. And for example, we have taken into account all these astrophysical uncertainties and experimental systematics, and in a consistent way using Bayesian statistics. And what we found is that this can lead to a small improvement in the agreement of between hints of the detection and exclusion bound, for example. So to be more precise, so this is the dark matter mass and the spin independent cross section. So here there's no CDMS signature, but it should like here more or less. And then here this is cogent, this is gamma, and this and the blue one corresponds to the crest region, and this is the xenon upper bound. This left plot just corresponds to a xenon upper bound, which considers only the system, or where only the experimental systematic are taken into account.
Can you explain what's going on with that line on the left-hand side there, the xenon line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one, which is a bit fuzzy.
Yeah.
But I think that this is due to the sampling of the posterior PDF, so that maybe here it's a bit low, because this is very difficult to sample this kind of posterior, because they are flat almost, since there is no detection. And so this is why the bounds are a bit wiggling over there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not really a physical meaning. It's also because those huge cross section and small masses are not very, I would say that it's because the PDF is mostly flat.
Does that mean that, but that's got to be, that wiggling has to be unphysical, right? That's
yeah.
So how should I think about that region right now? So that suggests to me that maybe that region, I don't really know what the limits are from this calculation just yet.
Well, you should just expect that.
I think it just means that it's not completely converged numerically.
Right, so.
It's
it makes a
problem,
a difference whether it kind of goes like that or whether it goes like that, right?
No, one expect that just rises up that way,
but
because.
You do have some sensitivity at lower masses and higher cross sections, right? So I don't.
What do you mean, this?
Yeah.
No, but this is a problem of the sampling. This is not a physical. I mean, the bound should just go up that way, and just go up, because this is what expected from also the theoretical rate. A xenon nuclear cannot be sensitive.
How are you treating the light yield here at xenon?
We have marginalized, I mean, we have added on the likelihood a Gaussian probability that takes into account this spread in this L effective function, which is not very known, and then we marginalize over that. This is why maybe our also bound is a bit pushed to the right hand side. It's a bit less constraining than the true of the xenon one.
So do you do the marginalization analytically or numerically? I mean, do you sample the...
The background is marginalized analytically before, and then we marginalize numerically over L effective.
Yeah, so I guess that would explain why it jumps around more down at the low masses, because it's going to be more sensitive to the sample.
But, I mean, already the chain contains a lot, like 1,000,000 points. I mean, it's a long chain, but it's very difficult to sample it. I mean, to keep a multi-nest staying there and sampling it. So this is why it gets a bit wiggling, but it's not physical. No. So, okay, so this is without considering for fixed astrophysics. And then when we marginalize over the astrophysics, so considering velocity distribution that are derived directly from the density profile, like Navarro, Frank, and White, or ENAS, so here is the Navarro, Frank, and White then shown, we have that the there is a slight improvement in all the compatibility of the region, because the upper bounds due to the volume effect moves a bit to the right, and also the region are a bit larger still due to volume effect. And even if we consider other type of distribution, the matter density profile like a Nastro profile or isothermal one, they all give more or less the same, because there are not enough data to constrain the astrophysics.
How do you derive the velocity distribution from the density profile?
Inverting, I mean, we
the adenine.
Yes.
And you assume isotropic.
Yes. The assumption. Yes, isotropy and spherically symmetric. And
so there's no anisotropy profile.
No.
So what you're doing the inverting, okay.
Yes, no, it's just based on the energy. Okay. And then maybe you already have seen this at the conference, but just to give you an idea, so the current status is quite puzzling, but then it's expected that there will be soon new data in the data detection side. For example, the Lux detector should come out with some bound of a partial run. And then to validate the procedure and to go then down to super this Lux Zeppelin, we should be competitive with Xenon 100, one ton. While it is competitive more or less with Xenon 100. Then there is this Dark Side 50, which is based on argon, which is running now at the Gran Sasso. And this is an intermediate nucleus mass, which is not yet competitive with the other, but it's like it will also then upgrade it to ton scale the detector. And then there is Super CDMS running. And the important thing is that there is a special running mode, which is called this low threshold CDMS light. I don't know if you can read it from here, that can allow Super CDMS to say something about this light whimper region. And apparently, talking with Gianfranco, there will be also silicium in the detectors due to the recent event. There might be.
CDMS light is going on now, right? I mean,
yes.
I was talking. I was referring to super CDMS.
With the next generation of. But this plot should be from this year, right?
This should be from this year. Yeah. Then in a slightly more distant future, there will be this ton scale the detector. For example, there are several plans like super CDMS, and then among the other, there will be the Xenon 1 ton, which will be running at the Gran Sasso, and the science run is expected to run in 2015, and they expect to reach a sensitivity of 10^-47, like two order of magnitude below what they have now, and to probe a huge parameter space of the WIMP. And this is the kind of detector I will talk about in the next part of the talk, because this was just to illustrate what are the issues in data detection, and from the experimental side and from the theoretical side. But now I will just focus on the theoretical uncertainty related to the detection and to future experiments. So, for the rest of the talk, we will suppose, for example, that we have an evidence for dark matter in Xenon 1 ton, And what one wants to do, the first things is to know what are the dark matter parameters that can explain the events in the detector, for example, the mass, the cross-section, or nucleus. But the dark matter detection experiment have some limitations, and what we hope is that we can break the degeneracy that links the cross-section and the mass in the dark matter detection experiment with some other experiment, and we will use for that the neutrino signal seen in ice cube coming from the sun, because they are sensitive to the same set of dark matter parameters. And then I will comment about the astrophysical issues that affect those kind of reconstruction of WIMP parameters. So for the setup, as I said, we were going to consider xenon one-ton experiment, and just to remind, this is the experiment, the theoretical rate we expect for the dark matter detection, where here there is the particle physics part, and here we take into consideration the two contribution from a spin-independent scalar interaction and also a spin-dependent one. And the parameter, the theoretical parameter we want to reconstruct is the dark matter mass and the two cross-sections. And so this I already show you. This is what a xenon one-ton is expected to be sensitive to. So our benchmark point will be in between these two lines. And but it's also sensitive, even a bit less than the spin independent, to the spin dependent cross section. This is the current bound of xenon 100, and then xenon 110 is expected to go down up to 2 order of magnitude to 10 to minus 42 centimeter square. And for the particle physics part, we will have to consider also that there are a huge nuclear uncertainty that affects the structure function in the spin-dependent cross-section, and both the rate in general is also affected by the astrophysical uncertainties. The way we proceed is to implement all this in a Bayesian framework, and so we took three benchmark points, which are consistent by a light WIMP mass, an intermediate one, and a heavy WIMP. And those benchmarks are characterized by, for example, the benchmark A, is dominated by the spin-dependent interaction, the count in xenon, where the spin-independent is small, gives a small contribution. B has both contribution sizable, while benchmark C has the spin-dependent contribution, which is negligible with respect to the spin-dependent one. And this kind of benchmark, they more or less resume all possibilities that we can have with the WIMP parameters. So then we have produced fake mock data from these three benchmark points, and then we try to reconstruct our theoretical parameters using the multiness algorithm, and I mean by means of Bayes theorem. So given the likelihood and how our theory describes the data, and given a prior for the data, we can get the posterior PDF. And the prior are particularly are important, of course, as a choice, in particular the prior on the dark matter mass, which I will discuss, we show you later. But this is our choice. It's a flat prior on the log in order not to favor any particular order of magnitude, since we don't know the order of magnitude of the dark matter mass. And then we sample, as usual, the posterior PDF with by using multinest.
So I have a question about how this works. So we know that when you get to very heavy dark matter masses, that the distributions of the events looked the same, right? Yes. That it all just becomes the reduced mass, and so
yes, yeah.
10 TeV is the same as 1 TeV, basically.
Yeah.
So how do I think about that if I've got a prior? Let's suppose, for instance, I took my prior from 10 GeV, like you have, but instead of up to 1 TeV, I took it up to a million TeV or a billion, you know, whatever,
yeah.
Right? Then would that then cause me to just excessively over, because I know that those all look the same, does that kind of just skew me then naturally, no matter what the data look like?
Yes, I have a slide on this after that, so I can show you. But yeah, this will affect the reconstruction.
I'll wait till you get to the slide. But then I guess my question will be, how given that, then how do you think about where to put this upper bound?
Okay, we choose it thinking that we are treating WIMPs. So we can discuss if it is 1 TeV or at most 10 TeV, but we cannot push it much further because otherwise it's not really a WIMP anymore. So we just stay in the conservative range of WIMP, so from 10 GeV to 1 TeV.
At some point, you must run into unitarity bounds.
Oh yeah, yeah. In terms of the for a thermal WIMP, for sure, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, I just mean in the sense that all these things look the same from this particular experiment. So there's a subtlety here, in how much your prior is going to influence what things look like.
I assume she's going to get a flat posterior in the end.
Yeah. That's
a cutoff really, because she's taking it prior that's flat in the log of the mass. You only really need the overall value to estimate what your upper cut is going to be. So, yeah.
I guess a simple test or question to be would be just change that from 1 TeV to 10 TeV and see what happens to.
If you look at the 2D plot, it should probably not show. Nothing changes, the range becomes bigger. If you were to marginalize down 1 E and then hide away the prior, that could be troublous because then you don't see it anymore. But if you look, and in the space where the prior is, the cut is evident, there's no worries, right? The worry is where you actually
marginalize,
integrate it out, then you pick up extra volume that you might not know about.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's just, it's there for you to see. So.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if this ever becomes a problem, you can just see the likelihood anyway. You just sample it well enough to have a converged profile likelihood.
It can make any difference, right? Because the likelihood is the size of flat in that direction. As he was saying,
but that's what I'm saying. I mean, even once you marginalize down or profile down to one dimension, you're not going to have any prior effects.
The other thing, of course, you can hope for is that you can get a hint of the value to mass from ice cube, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
If you manage to, in that case, you can really play this game of
compilation. Sure. Yeah.
But from the detection only, it is true that extending the higher values of the mass, is completely degenerate from this collision.
Yeah. Okay. This is just to show you that the choice of our benchmark can comes from a paper on the MSSM 25. So it can be, it's a natural realization of some configuration of the neutralino. So this is, for example, the spin-dependent cross-section versus the spin-independent. And we can have all kind of possibilities and combination, for example, dominated by the spin-dependent one or dominated by the spin-independent or something which will be just to which our experiment will not be sensitive to up to, generation. So, and our benchmark point that we took are more or less in this range here. And this is but the choice of having a neutralino dark matter, it's not really, we can have other particle physics models that have the same behavior. They both have sizable spin dependent, they both have both contributions, spin independent and spin dependent. This is, for example, the universal extra dimension, and for example, this is another again behavior of universal extra dimension or warped extra dimension, where the neutrino, right, and the neutrino is the dark matter candidate. Or this is again another dark matter model. So the choice of turning off both cross section is takes into account the whole particle physics models. And so first, this is the reconstruction with the xenon detector, and I'm going to show you those are the results for the benchmark A. This is the mass, the spin independent, and then spin dependent cross section, and again the mass. The benchmark A is the one which is light and has a small spin independent contribution, and it's dominated by the spin dependent one. And what we can learn is that when the one contribution is small, it is very difficult to be reconstructed because it is biased on top of that. And while if its value is large, then it is reconstructed fairly well. This is the 68 and 95% confidence level. And we have these two long tail of degeneracy, of course, because we have turned on the two components. If we had only one, we just could have a nice detection right there. And also, this is why we get this nice spot of detection here, because it's just compensating, for example, for small event here and there. So this is the first issue that we have to take care on, is that we have two cross section, and so the degeneracy between them. But the mass, since the dark matter is light, is fairly well reconstructed with within the 68% confidence level. In the second case, this is, for example, the benchmark B, which has a 100 mass, and we and the spin independent cross section. We see, for example, here that the mass start to show this degeneracy tail, which is expected for light detection experiment, because the number of the spectrum starts to look the same for all this heavy WIMP. And which is worse in the benchmark C case, where this is 500 GeV, we get this huge degeneracy already in the 1 sigma region, and then the 95% is just flat here. And also, those bubbles here are not physically, but again, it's an issue of sampling this posterior PDF, the molecule, which is very, very flat. So we, even keeping multiness going, it was very difficult to get rid of all these small bubbles that have no meaning. And I forgot, but all the reconstructions were done in the case of very without Noisan's parameters. So this is for fixed astrophysics and fixed nuclear uncertainties. And in order to try to break the degeneracy in the mass of the dark matter, we can go. We can still use the direct detection itself, but combine different nuclei. For example, this is a paper of Miguel Pato and Gianfranco et al. And here we have the behavior of different nuclei for three benchmarks, a light, intermediate, and heavy one. And then here is what one gets if we combine the three different nuclei. So the region shrinks again, but still in the high mass, it's more difficult to get rid of the degeneracy. But this is one way to go for to breaking the degeneracy in the mass. But still, we have the degeneracy in the two cross sections, so the spin independent versus the spin dependent for the benchmark A that looks like this. Or, for example, B, they all look like more or less the same, so this is the case of B. In order to break this, we use the neutrino signal from that can be seen from ice cube. So as you all know, the dark matter can accumulate in the center of the sun and then annihilate and produce neutrinos that can be seen as upgoing muons in the ice cube detector. And here, the process of accumulation and annihilation, it's a balance between the capture rate and the annihilation rate. And in order to keep our analysis simple, we just use the approximation of steady state. So we get rid of the annihilation cross-section as and this becomes a function of the capture rate. So we don't have to deal with this extra parameter. And then the capture rate depends here on the dark matter parameters and mostly on the spin-dependent cross-section, because the composition of the sun is mostly hydrogen. And since it's hydrogen, it's a pure proton, we don't have any nuclear uncertainties for this spin-dependent interaction, because we don't have to parameterize the coherence of the nucleus in the scattering. And so using ice cube, these are the latest results from ice cube 779.
Wait, so can I ask a question there? Yeah. Is that necessarily true in a mass independent fashion? Because if you actually want to capture these things, the iron is, of course, a significantly smaller fraction of the mass. Yeah. But on the other hand, it's much easier to lose energy when you scatter off of iron. So
yeah, also the cross-section goes like a squared.
Oh, no, but I mean, even in the spin-dependent case, right? I mean, you could imagine. Well, I mean, I know in the spin-independent case, then you can win, but...
Yeah.
But if I were really, really heavy, then...
Kind of hard to create scenarios where iron dominates the capture rate. Oxygen is more often because there's about 100 times as much oxygen as there is iron.
Yeah, I know, but I was just thinking in terms of kinematics, right?
Yeah.
So...
Even once you go up to large masses, it's hard to be dominated by iron. I mean, it contributes. It's important.
But even if it's oxygen, then I guess that, well, in the spin-dependent case, well, let's see, what's the spin of iron, actually? I don't know off the top of my head. It's
iron's 56 is spin by sodium. So you don't get much spin-dependent capture on it.
I think maybe it's the nitrogen or the silicium that contributes to the spin-dependent case. But the other are not...
You can actually get substantial capture rate. I mean, we just consider the solar composition and just calculate the capture rate for...
Yeah, I mean, it's not an assumption, because we used dark 2Z as it is and we didn't do anything...
Yeah, so my question was just, is that always true even at the highest masses?
No, it actually doesn't yet.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, the public version doesn't.
Okay. But
I mean, it's only in very special cases where it really matters a lot. It's a pretty good approximation to say that this independent capture is on hydrogen.
Yeah, then maybe I guess then one can should be careful with the form factor at that point, because the velocity can be high and then can be biased by the modelization of the form factor. So, yeah, it's not...
If the capture on hydrogen, it doesn't depend on the nuclear uncertainties, but I thought you still have to worry about the calculation of these AN and AP parameters, and they depend on the quark.
Yeah, I mean, but but this is just in case if you really start from a model, so you just take a really supersymmetry and then you get by hand IN and AN. But here we are just saying, okay, we took the neutralino configuration as just benchmark, but then we transform and suppose to be equal coupling to neutron and to proton, also to be to have this complementarity to work at the most we could, because xenon is sensitive to spin dependent on proton, while ice cube it's on neutron. The other way. on proton it's of course the sun, and then the xenon is neutron. So if we could playing with AN, you can turn off and on, one of the two components.
What works on is the assumption of steady state, because many of those models will typically be violated, no?
Yeah, no, but those are we checked, and we were okay within 10-15% of the steady state. So at the most, we are just pushing or overestimating a bit the counts that we have in the detector, but it's just 15% of the most. Yeah. Okay, and so this is the latest result from IceCube 79. And then again, the 86 with the deep core should go again for in 5 years' time, at the same time of Xenon, go down up to 10^-42. So they have more or less the two detectors the same sensitivity. And okay, so we don't have nuclear uncertainty, but we do have again astrophysical uncertainty for all of them. And so for IceCube, again, those are the benchmarks, just to remind you. And these are the number of muons that are predicted for each of the three benchmarks, and we choose a particular branching ratio, 1:1 per specific channel. So the right one, of course, can go on into tau plus, tau minus. Then the 100 GV as the most natural particle physics, I mean, model we do is to go into W plus and minus. And for the C, to boost the signal, we choose a particular channel with its pure neutrinos, which is a bit weird for a generic WIMP, but it can be found, for example, in Kaluza-Klein or extra-dimension model that prefers to go into neutrinos.
Great, sorry, what are those? What are these numbers?
The expected number of muons that we get from this benchmark, yes. And in 5 years, so we are doing the prediction for IceCube in 5 years, so the first and the last one do not produce enough muons to be disentangled from the background, so what we get is just a flat likelihood, so I'm not going to show you those two benchmarks, the prediction from IceCube, while in this case we get still a detection.
This last scenario that you have, see, so you have a WIMP mass of 500 GeV and then you annihilate directly into neutrinos.
Yes.
So that even gets you a worse signal because you get then significant absorption of neutrinos in the sun. So actually lower energy neutrinos would probably be more favorable.
No, I mean, we get a small signal because this benchmark is dominated by the spin-independent contribution, so we produce very low rate of neutrinos. But then this annihilation chance...
The point is that these neutrinos get absorbed in the sun, like a significant fraction of those. So if you annihilate into WW and get the neutrinos at lower energies than around 100 or 200 GeV, that might be more detectable, actually.
Okay,
just a comment.
That might already be taken into account in Winton. I don't remember. I mean, I guess you put the monochromatic neutrinos through WIMPs in. It has an option for neutrinos, does it?
I'm not sure. I mean, we just put branching ratio 1 into neutrinos of mu tau, but we didn't change nothing in WIMPs. No.
It probably is completely treated.
And then also we wanted to have a particular channel which could reflect, for example, extra dimension, which are heavy, and which we produce more fermions than Ws. So.
But effectively, in that case where you have 7.8 event, we assume that there's no detection.
But you say you can up the number, right? That's your point.
If we go into Ws. And then the likelihood of IceCube is we use the one model with the Dark Suzy program. And the only detection that we get is for B, which we have more or less 60 muons. And we see that it's completely not sensitive to the spin independent case because the likelihood just cut out at 100 GeV and then it's completely flat. While it is sensitive to the spin dependent one, while this is the 68% confidence level, it more or less finds the right spot. But we don't have a sensitivity, a good resolution in the mass because we could not use the spectral information from IceCube because it's not available yet. And again, all these bubbles are not physical. So then what can we learn if we combine them? And this is in the case of the detection, we see that for the spin dependent case, this was the only xenon, and this is when we combine xenon and ice cube. And for example, we get a detection combining both, and we get a nice prediction for the mass in this case. And for the spin dependent cross section, while we get only an upper bound for the spin independent one. So this is again xenon 1 ton alone with this degeneracy between spin dependent and spin independent. And here we have the both combined that gives us an upper bound on the spin dependent, and this is marginalized over the mass. And yes, this is an upper bound on the spin dependent one. This is what we can learn combining both. And for instance, in case of no detection, we can still improve our reconstruction if we combine ice cube and xenon. This is the case of spin independent and mass only xenon for the benchmark C. And this is what we get if we combine it with ice cube. So we get a nice determination of, I mean, both upper and lower bound for the spin independent, and we can just cut off all the tail, which was almost flat. And this is what looked like the same reconstructed point in the spin independent and spin dependent parameters. And here it's clear that a no detection in ice cube gives an upper bound which is of the order 10⁻⁴1⁴2, which is the sensitivity of ice cube, while the spin independent cross section, so yeah, it gets an upper bound like this. And then the benchmark A, which has again no detection, behaves more or less the same. And here there is the discussion on the prior that we choose for the benchmark B. This is for the prior of from 10 to 1 TV, the spin independent and spin dependent cross section, and both experiment. And this is what one would get integrating, marginalizing over the mass dimension if the prior was from 1 GV, sorry, here there is a mistake, it's 100 TV. One would get this huge tail of, this tail at high mass that can also give us some contribution to the event, and this tail would be a bit larger than this one, but not dramatically less. So cutting out the prior cut out all this high mass part. And this is more remarkable in the case of the benchmark C, which is heavy. And this is what we have from 10 GV to 1 TV. And this is what we could get if the prior was from 10 GV up to 100 TV. We will get a huge mass volume effect because very heavy masses and a very high cross section would like to explain the events seen in both the detector. But as we said, we choose to keep in mind that we want to stay with a wimp, it's in most common definition, so we use those kind of priors. And now this is just the last part where to show you the inclusion of the uncertainties. First, the nuclear uncertainties on the structure function for the spin-dependent part are important. For example, this is the structure function for the coupling to proton, which is the one the axial part, which is the one we are interested in. And those are the two most different parameterization that are available in literature. We have done all the calculation with the black one, which is the most recent one and comes from around 2012. And this is an old calculation. And as you can see, there is a huge difference between those two. And those gives you, for example, a factor of 3 of difference in the number of events. So depending on which one of the two parameterization one takes, you can get a bias in the reconstruction of events, for example, overshoot or undershoot the spin-dependent cross-section. So we have to take into account this ambiguity in the definition of the spin-dependent cross-section. So we parameterize, we take Nuisance parameters, a fit. No, it's not really a fit, it's just a function that goes smoothly from this one to this one with 3 free parameters. And here, for example, this is shown the mean of this function. So, and this is how we deal with the nuclear uncertainty. And the other way, for the astrophysical uncertainty, we keep fixed the velocity distribution, but we just marginalize over the astrophysical parameter, like the local velocity, the escape velocity, and the density with a Gaussian likelihood. And those are the results. This is just a 1 sigma contour, the 68% confidence level for the benchmark A, in this case, the light one. And so this is the fixed astrophysic contour, and on top of that, there are the varied and the varied plus nuclear uncertainties, and here the same for the mass and the spin dependent. And what we can learn is that, again, the astrophysic, take into account the Nuisance parameter, we enlarge your contour, and the nuclear uncertainties are subdominant with respect to the astrophysical one, because the two contours just overlap on top of the other.
Is it surprising that the large nuclear uncertainties doesn't really make a difference, because it's factor of 3, it's huge,
right? Yeah, but not really at the end, because we took An equal to, the coupling of the dark matter in such a way that we just keep the axial part, the axial coupling and not the other one. There is the S00 is less uncertain than the S11. And so at the end, it doesn't make really a difference.
It shows that if you go from one curve to the other, yeah, it's a factor of 3 difference in the number of predicted counts.
Yeah, something like that. But then at the end, if you take into...
Does it go up or down? With respect to the case you showed before.
It goes down.
It goes down, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, it goes down.
Should I read anything into the fact that the contours, including the nuclear uncertainties, seem to be slightly tighter than the ones just including the asteroid? Is it just scattering noise? Mm.
You just think uploading.
Looking at the neck there, for example. Yeah.
No, they are mostly one on top of each other, I would, yeah. And then the last part is to take into account the velocity distribution. As I show you, again, the Maxwell-Boltzmann doesn't really describes well the tails of the distribution. Again, here, it's a plot of this time the Via Lattea simulation plus the Maxwell-Boltzmann on top. And the most important part are for the direct detection, this high tail, as I told you, but for the neutrino signal is this the low tail, because only low velocity WIMPs can get captured into the sun. So the velocity distribution enters in different way in the two experiments. And what we have done is just to take the mean of several numerical n-body simulation and to simulate our benchmark point with this new n-body, with assuming an a velocity distribution that comes from n-body, and then to reconstruct with a pure Maxwell-Boltzmann case, which is what one would do in case of a detection. And this is what we get. So this magenta, so this pinky curve is the Maxwell-Boltzmann case. And then we have the Aquarius simulation, which is in blue. And then here there is the n-body simulation. And those are the two extreme realization that brackets the Maxwell-Boltzmann one. This is for the case of the dark matter mass and the spin-independent cross-section. And this is what we get for spin-dependent and mass. And the only thing is that at the end, the bias in the velocity distribution shape is more or less fairly robust and doesn't really affect the reconstruction of the WIMP parameters. This is the only thing we learn from these two this plot. And I think it's
the Aquarius simulation is cool. Shuts off earlier is because it got heavier tail.
Yes. This is why. But this is the heavier realization that you can get. So this is why we bracket between these two. Yeah. And also those are the, in any case, always the 68% confidence region. So the difference is not.
So in this case, you do not take into account the possible uncertainty on the position of the solar system with respect to the solar the scale radius of the halo, right?
No.
So I might imagine you should also marginalize over that uncertainty. And also the uncertainty on the concentration of, because for example, you know, Aquarius, there's only six halo, and their concentration may not be the concentration of our Milky Way halo. So.
Yeah, okay, no, we didn't refine up to that. We just wanted to see if there was a dramatic difference or just to bracket our uncertainties if the reconstruction was robust or not. So we did, it was more
and
sampling.
The same game that you were using for the parameterization
issue.
And so, okay, so here are my conclusion, and considering two different experiments and combining in case of the detection, what this can help in reconstructing the dark matter parameters, and we can also have learned something in case if one experiment has a non-detection, and this can constrain and at least give an upper bound from one of the on the WIMP parameters. And one thing which is maybe we could improve our analysis is to use the spectral information in the ice cube likelihood, which is not experimentally available yet, but maybe in future this can really break the degeneracy in the mass of the dark matter. And then some of the astrophysical parameters can of course be the uncertainty can be reduced, for example, by the Gaia satellite, especially on the density of the local density of the dark matter. So then the reconstruction will be less affected by this astrophysical uncertainty. So, okay, this is this.
Thank you. Any further questions?
I guess I can comment some more about the spectral stuff.
Yeah.
So the spectral and angular likelihood is also publicly available in DuckSUSE for the 22 string data.
Yes.
And eventually it will also have the 79 string spectral response and so on as well. We don't have a time frame sorted out for that.
Okay. No, no, because I mean, if we could have had the 79, we could have done some estimation, but the 22 is very much different than the 86, so we didn't use it.
And we're analyzing also the 79 string data now with the actual spectral analysis, so that should be available maybe half a year from now. And what's currently in the for the 22 string, as I mentioned, what's released, it's a very crude, like, energy estimator, so that's probably not very helpful, but
but it means that the whole likelihood construction in DuckSUSE can work with a better energy estimator, which is what we'll have with the 79 string data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you say just, back numbers, between 100 GB and 1 GB, to get an energy resolution which is 100%, 50%, 10%?
we haven't really worked on that yet. I mean, but it should be maybe on the order of like 20%, 30%. But it depends also on the energy range. And so if you just have the through going events, and of course the energy resolution is also not very good. So but actually for the lower masses, it should actually be better where the event is fully contained in the deep core detector. So this is like from this low mass of like 30 GV up to on the order of like 100 GV.
So what is the limiting factor then in the energy resolution? What is the hardest going to be?
It's not that hard. I mean, it's just that current analysis didn't include this yet. So, and also, I mean, using the energy reconstruction had some difficulties at the beginning. Was most related to uncertainties in the ice properties, but that should be on track now. So.
But in this case, even like a 50%, 100% answer, it would immensely help. At least in the case where you get attention, largely because of prior issue, because then you can let the client go wherever it wants. But then if you get a mass estimate,
this is exactly what we showed, even with 22 string data. I mean, we had about 50%, even with that, and we got a much better.
Yeah, but we didn't there. Using something just without any information.
Although I wonder about this point about the attenuation of high energy neutrinos can mess that up, right? If you have a really heavy particle, even if you start seeing neutrinos from it, if they're attenuated, then...
Well, you would still see like a cutoff at that
end. Yeah, I'm just wondering whether there's some degeneracy between,
Yeah, if you go to very high wind masses and where you are dominated, high energy part is dominantly cut off, then it will be hard to do.
What kind of masses are we talking about? Like the 10 TB or?
No, already, above 100 GV, you need to start to worry about attenuation.
I get that. But in order to get to the regime where you have degeneracy, basically, you cannot tell.
I think
100 TV going from
300. I would probably say like if you have 1 TV or above, but at that point you need to start worrying about that.
So when you say there's a cutoff, do you mean there's a cutoff due to the fact that attenuation kicks in, or you're saying you still see a cutoff at the dark matter mass? How abruptly does the attenuation kick in? Because I would think that anything that makes neutrinos above 100 GeV would suffer from this.
Yes, everything above 100.
So you don't have to go to a 10 TeV WIMP. I mean, if you're assuming direct annihilation to neutrinos, anything above 100 GeV, you'd expect this kind of suppression.
But that's if you're going directly to neutrinos.
Right, because a lot lower then if you have like different annihilation channels, I mean that anyway is like a different question. Like you have a mix of annihilation channels, which also.
Okay, so I guess the basic question is, how quickly does the cutoff, you know, set in due to the attenuation, and is that going to be what you see, or are you going to actually, is it going to be a gradual cutoff, and you finally do see the dark matter mass cutoff?
It's not really a cutoff, right? It's a reprocessing of the energy.
Right.
It's smaller.
Yeah.
Well, because the spectrum is my energy, so. You observe
spectrum. Right, but you still have sensitivity. I mean, you still see neutrinos. In that case, you still see neutrinos from the sun. And, you know, maybe with some spectral information, you can still tell that, you know, 1 dB wind from a 10 dB wind,
But it certainly seems like it makes this question about just saying, well, the neutrinos are going to break the degeneracy at high masses. It certainly makes that a much subtler question.
And you know, this is why we haven't tried, because you know, in absence of any detailed information on you know, the energy resolution of the instrument, well, the other part is already encoded in this very same
right?
So in principle, one should have to run the same exercise getting that into
account. But I mean, breaking the mass degeneracy, that just shown here, you can do without the spectral information, so the first approximation, right? So, I mean, it's just that it'll be better if you have spectral information from ICE-Q. The fact that, you know, in some of these benchmarks, they had no detection at all with ICE-Q without any spectral information is enough to break the degeneracy. So it's still going to be helpful.
Yeah, but isn't it always easier to come up with, I mean, but that's, that. This is making some assumptions about what it's annihilating into, right?
Well, sure, but I mean, this is...
I cannot detect something for a lot of reasons, is all I'm saying.
Right.
I cannot detect it because you're capturing a very few of them, and so I'm getting a small rate, or I can not detect it because they're annihilating into something different, or... Right, I mean, I have various options.
Sure, I mean, if you want to sneak out the annihilation into... You know, hidden sector particles. You can always escape.
Well, I don't even necessarily mean, you know, I mean, yes, you can always do it at hidden sector particles, but I just mean, like, I don't know, is what if I'm annihilating into Higgses, right? I mean, then I'll get a different spectrum. I mean, there are a lot of different possibilities here. So I don't know, once I start playing with even standard model annihilation channels, how much that's going to influence how I interpret non-discovery, right?
Well, that's different, because it's just going to give you biases. If you misinterpret, for example, the animation channel, it's going to give you bias in where the line goes through. You still have a line, and not the limit, but it's just going to be wrong. It's going to be off. And that's what it should be.
If you annihilate the Higgs, it might just shuffle you onto its own.
I think the issue is the reshuffling, though, right? Without the spectral, if you lose spectral information, you're trying to break the mass degeneracy, right? So I think the issue is that if you are reshuffling the energy, then you really don't have a handle on the mass unless you know what the channel is.
No, I'm talking about reshuffling the contours that Chiara showed.
I
mean, if, you know, those are without spectral information and still doing reasonably well in terms of breaking the mass degeneracy. So I think you're still going to be able to do relatively well.
But your point was also that even absent the detection, you do well on the mass degeneracy, right? And that has to have some. That has to be very just prior dependent, right?
It is, yeah.
No, I mean, you need to have a detection in the direct detection.
It's a what?
It's benchmark dependent.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, but I mean, prior in the sense of, like, you have some assumption about what you think your annihilation channel is, right?
Well, you could do this for every possible annihilation channel, and the point I was trying to make was that I don't think the results would be massively different. I mean, if you read...
It doesn't annihilate, though. I mean, direct detection, you don't even know.
Oh, okay, sure.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, it could be asymmetric, right?
Yeah. I mean, this might be a situation where they're trying to use. If you did have a detection in the low energy, not in the high energy, you might be able to say something. Like even like if you did superheat neutrinos too, because that's almost like a calorimeter for all the hadronic energy that went in, and then seeing that versus not seeing something in high energies might tell you something.
So the analysis was really tailored on like thermal winds, like the nice ones we kind of. But of course, you know, if you start, you know, seeing these rays, you know, or absence of a ray from the sun, then you have to go through all these possibilities much more carefully.
I like how the publicly available information is referenced as Dark Susie and Scott.
That's a bit funny. But, I mean, it's also Ice Cube, right? The paper was the whole Ice Cube collaboration.
Well, I guess if you don't see anything, that you can hide it in many ways. But what about this case you were assumed that you had a signal? In that case, could you marginalize over the final state, or even this assumption that you take about being an equilibrium between capture and emulation? Would you get some information on what's the lowest possible signal to
We can get the lowest possible. No, we didn't, but this you can, yeah, because you know the capture rate. So if you can get what's the spin dependent is, then you can get the capture rate and then a bound on.
Oh, but the spin, I mean, you have this combination of spin dependent, spin dependent.
You bring in this extra parameter.
But still, I mean, you have to produce somehow signal, so I guess.
Yeah, but this is more or less reconstructed, so you can get an upper bound on the sigma v in that case. But this is the only case you can a lower bound. Yeah, sorry, a lower bound. Yeah, but in this case we always two channels, which are more than more promising. If we could have taken BB bar, it was impossible to see something. Because for Ice Cube, it's better.
So you would be saying, okay, I need to have this minimum cross section, it has to go into W.
Yeah. Or tau is, yeah. That gives you.
The other obvious point to make is that you already have results for the 79 strings detector, right? And you know what we can expect is to go up to 86, right?
Yeah.
Which is for this number of strings that are in the ice now. And so, so a very high masses, so above 100 GeV, probably not going to get, going to go down in parameter space more than a factor of a few, right? A factor of five.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Carsten, but I think most of the improvements between 79 and 86 will be in the analysis, not so much in the detector.
Well, the high energy analysis is quite well developed, so there will not really be much of an improvement. The only improvement that will be coming there is from using some energy spectral information, and so that might improve there a little bit, but. Most improvements we expect really at lower masses.
But that doesn't mean
no,
that the
effective area improves. Yeah, the only effective area.
We improve the factor of few.
Yes. It's well because we have two more strings so in the ice, so the I mean two more deep core strings for the IC86 detector. Mm-hmm. So that.
Not quite a bit.
I think
the majority of deep core was already there.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we can still expect significant improvements.
Okay.
So just wanted to mention that when we were choosing these parameters, it was really hard to find, of course, mm-hmm. Something that would be accessible with a decent rate with IC86 and not already moved down by.
79, yeah.
Okay, before thanking Kara again, for the rest of the week, this NOMAS meeting starts tomorrow, so at the moment we don't have any other discussions planned. So, but yeah, things change, and maybe you might want to schedule something or other in the next 3 days or so. At the moment, it's free for all for the rest of the week. Because there's plenty of interesting talks on your contributing to those anyhow, starting tomorrow. And if there's nothing else that comes up, we'll
make sure. Are all of those talks here?
Yeah.
Are
here being this auditorium?
No, here being in KITP. They're not over in the physics department or something.
Because I know they are here.
Yeah, they're scheduled
on the wiki. Yeah, it starts tomorrow. Are you giving talks? You are? You are you giving a talk?
I don't think so. No.
Anybody else in this room? No? Okay. Okay. Thanks.